The Guardian.
Football Weekly with James Richardson.
Today, derby drama, Mancunian candidates, Van Persie free kick sees Samir disappear faster than a British barbecue, 6 points clear, United's title bid gains currency, as does Rio Ferdinand, but not in a nice way. We round up all the derby drama and post-game shame. Elsewhere, end of days approaches as Torres' scoring streak continues, and you'll never walk alone. For Rodgers, it really is hammer's time as Liverpool win at Upton Park. Abroad, Seed, Rafa and Philippe do their continental thing. Messi eats Muller for breakfast, Falcao, the wonder of Totti, and the dive of the season. All of that and so much more in today's Football Weekly. Well, what a pleasure and privilege, I must say, it is today to be here in the pod with such a stellar lineup. There's Raphael Honigstein over there.
Hello, James.
Hi, Rafa. Philippe Auclair.
Good morning, James.
And Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
Great news. Now, Raphael Honigstein, Tom Cruise at the Etihad intro sorted, says Rafa. RVP was Top Gun, mission possible for Ferguson. Show me the money, can't handle the truth. What a big game. I barely know where to start. Should we start with showing love for Man United and their glorious rampaging counter-attacks, Barry?
We could do. They were very much under the cosh for the first 15 minutes. And their plan was clearly to sort of soak up the pressure and attack on the break, which is what they did. And they got the early goal, which allowed them to defend the lead they sort of didn't have the last time they played City, lost 1-0 and were roundly criticised for having similar-ish tactics. But it was a fantastic game, and, and they do deserve much love.
Yeah, I'm not so sure they wanted to counter-attack because their formation was very attacking, even slightly risky, I thought. You know, they had two guys in the middle and they seemed to be overrun, and I think they hardly got forward. When they did get forward, they had the real cutting edge, and it was just very, very efficient the way they did it.
The two Manchester United goals, the first two goals, were as good as team goals that I've seen this season in England. Absolutely magnificent. Both of them, completely different type of course. I mean, the first one just what you would call a straight counter-attack. The second coming from a phase of possession. Absolutely superb. Absolutely nothing to say. I don't think there's any reason why you should be hard on him for that.
Hmm. If you look at it tactically, I don't think there was necessarily one manager outsmarting the other. Simply a case of one team really making far fewer mistakes where it mattered in the final third than the other. Because right. I thought United looked very, very vulnerable in the beginning. And, you know, it had shades of, I wouldn't say Barcelona, but the way they were overrun the midfield in the beginning was very, very worrying. And you'd think, you know, why does he only line up with a flat back four? Isn't it very, very risky? It paid off, but on another day, it might not have.
Hmm. Perhaps the injuries had something to do with it. I mean, had he had Anderson, for example, maybe he would have made a different choice in his set, in his lineup, you think?
I don't know. I mean, the players that were really doubtful were all there, really. I mean, Valencia, for example. And he didn't have to pick any of the old guys, which I think helped.
He also didn't have to pick Mario Balotelli, which certainly was an advantage.
He's only got himself to blame, though, Mancini. And I think he's being delusionary to think that he somehow will be the manager that can get the best out of Mario Balotelli. I think in Italy, for the national team, it's a different scenario, because the power for a national manager comes from the moment he picks up the phone, you know, either in or out. So you cannot, as a player, if you want to be part of the team, afford to have a lot of bad performances. If you're signed on a four-year deal on money that no other club can pay, the power lies with the player, even if you don't acknowledge that. And Mancini, I think, somehow believes that he will be the one who sorts him out. And I think he's sacrificing a lot of the collective welfare on that particular egotistical trip of his, and I think it's completely irresponsible.
Potentially sacrificing his own future at City. But Balotelli does have his moments, but they've been very few and far between this season. He scored one Premier League goal. I mean, we can't forget it was him that provided the pass to Aguero that won City the title last season, so he is capable of having a huge influence on a game, but yesterday was not one of those days by any stretch of the imagination. I thought it was quite funny, actually. I saw pictures of Balotelli leaving the ground afterwards in a car festooned with sort of army camouflage.
Ah, yes.
Which made it, ironically, look incredibly conspicuous. I think there were some less than pleased City fans giving him a piece of their mind.
Poor chap, eh? Let's also, while we're wagging fingers, point one at Samir Nasri.
With pleasure.
For trying to use Edin Dzeko as his own personal Maginot line with similar levels of success. Astonishing, though, again, to see.
Well, I said yesterday, I thought Nasri couldn't have sort of lived up to stereotype better if he'd sort of
waved. Which stereotype is that? Sorry.
National stereotype, James. If I was his manager, he would never play again for me after that.
What was he doing in the wall anyway? Well, he wasn't, but what was...
Well, I would expect that...
But he's tiny.
Yes, but I would have expected that the decision to be part of the wall was not one that he took of his own accord, but maybe after some consultation, perhaps with his manager or his goalkeeper, or maybe on the training ground, I don't know.
But they must somehow know that he's lily-livered. I mean, I wouldn't pick...
I mean, it was a whole mess from beginning to the end, because right. Tevez walks out on his own accord to look after Rooney.
Yeah.
Then, as you said, Nasri becomes the man who is in line with the shot. He's the closest to where the ball is likely to go from, you know, someone taking it with the left of foot. And while you can understand that you need the bigger players inside because someone could also cross it, and as you know, United have all their tall players up at this point, a guy this week shouldn't be there. He should at the very least switch with Dzeko, because it's far more likely that they go, you know, across that way than the other, especially with Van Persie stepping up on his left. And Mancini afterwards said, you know, he was shouting, but nobody was listening. That doesn't really reflect well on him either. It's, I think in terms of the title race, in terms of where the two teams are, I'm not sure the game tells us that much. I think City could have easily won it as well. I think, you know, they were very even. As I said, United made fewer mistakes. But I think as far as Mancini's future is concerned, and, you know, all these sort of undercurrents, Balotelli, Tevez being unhappy, Nasri, I think it might have a bigger impact.
We're now in December, coming close to Christmas. We're still waiting for one single game that Alex Ferguson can use as a reference point for his team for the rest of the season. We still haven't seen one complete performance.
But he will use this one.
This and one, you could say, from
history,
the 15th minute
history
to the
will
55th.
Be rewritten.
So for the 40 minutes between the moment between the 16th when Rooney scores and the moment when Tevez goes on the pitch and threatens to change the whole game. Yes, during that period they were excellent, but...
I think it would be unreasonable of him to expect them to completely dominate in such a big game against such big opponents.
It's not a question of domination. I'm not talking about domination. I'm talking about a performance. You can be under the cosh and be dominated and still see that as a performance that you can refer to. This is the way we should defend. This is the way we've organised our midfield. This is, you know... No, that was not that case. You had a period, yes, which is about 40 minutes long, during which Manchester United actually garnered more possession of the ball suddenly. I think they started something like 76-24 in the first 15. Mm-hmm. Then it moved the other way around for the next 40 minutes or so. And you could say, yes, at this point, Manchester United had found an equilibrium, a balance, which they hadn't shown very often since the beginning of the season. Mm. But then it went pear-shaped. And honestly... I think we all thought when Zabaleta scored the equaliser that Manchester City would go on to win it.
Barry?
Well, while it was going pear-shaped, don't forget United also had a goal chalked off incorrectly, which would have put them 3-0 ahead and presumably end of game.
All right. Speaking of the end of the game, what about all that rumpus in the finale?
Well, we had a pitch invasion with Sky deigned not to show us. They were protecting us. It was very good of them.
They were doing a Joe Hart, if you like.
Were you talking about invasion? We were talking about like that young German who took a plane to the middle of Red Square. It was a one-man invasion, and not exactly...
Right.
Well, when the same thing happened with that Leeds supporter in the match against Sheffield Wednesday some time ago, we were shown it repeatedly. Rio Ferdinand also got hit by a coin, and there was like loads of loose change being pelted at Wayne Rooney as he took corners. But... this happens in games all over the country, and while it's most unsavoury, it's nothing new.
Mm. But it is, as you say, most unsavoury.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Rio Ferdinand could have lost his eye. Yeah. You know, I know that's a very mum thing to say. You'll have your eye out with that, but, you know, he got a nasty cut.
No, it was a horrible thing. A horrible thing. Now, that is enough for part one, I think. We'll save all the other Premier League delights for part two. Well, contentious Football Weekly moves now into part two. And Sunderland, Chelsea. Now, this was a surprise, Barry. Chelsea got a win there at the Stadium of Light.
Yeah.
Who'd have thought?
I had a feeling in my bones that Sunderland might get a result, and I was completely wrong. My bones betrayed me. For all that, they weren't as terrible as I've seen them this season. And they could have actually possibly rescued a point because they had to rattle the woodwork with a free kick, and Petr Cech had to make a splendid save towards the end. But Chelsea should really have been out of sight after half an hour. They screamed out of the blocks and were excellent. And Fernando Torres was superb.
Mm. Four goals in two games,
but with the caveat that the opposition in both games probably wasn't up to much.
Right, one of the worst teams in the Champions League, one of the worst teams in the Premier League.
That's never stopped him not scoring goals before.
Right.
Yes, exactly.
If it continues, though, you can only beat the teams in front of you. And if it does continue, there's going to be an awful lot of words eaten by an awful lot of people.
It's an 11 goals in all competitions from Fernando Torres since the beginning of the season.
11 in all competitions?
Yeah, absolutely. Which is not as ridiculous as...
Rafa,
but
meanwhile...
Why are you saying it? People have to...
Because a lot of people have said not just that he was bad, mm-hmm. which is an indisputable fact, I think, even... in the controversial atmosphere of this pod, but that he was finished and there was no way he could ever come back, that Fernando is gone. There's no sense in changing managers trying to bring the best out of Torres. You have to ship him out. And it might be that among all those kind of cold embers, there's a little bit of glowing fire still there that Rafa Benitez is bending over and going, on.
I don't think that's quite what people said. I think what they said is the Fernando of all, the quick, pacey...
Oh, yeah.
Defence-splitting Fernando is gone, and I don't think I saw anything on Saturday that would suggest that's anything but the case. He has lost pace.
Well, 11 goals in all competitions so far this season. I can't argue with numbers like that. And he heads off with Chelsea to the Club World Cup, where I think it's Thursday they face the Mexicans, Monterrey, mm-hmm. a tough-looking team. They're the CONCACAF Champions League winners. And, of course, there's Corinthians out there as well. Who have high hopes for this tournament. We'll talk more about the Club World Cup on Thursday with its goal line tech and its screaming crazy Japanese fans and all that kind of excitement. Rafa Benitez has already been there once before and won it.
And won it, absolutely.
With Inter.
As he always reminds people, my stay at Inter was not a failure. I won two titles.
No, there you go.
Which is true.
And he wrote a lovely letter, didn't he, at rafabenitez.com. Saying, thanks, everyone, for all your support.
Mm-hmm.
We're working very, very hard. You appreciate him, don't you, Philippe?
I do, very much so. And I appreciate what he's already done at Chelsea.
What's that?
I've seen Chelsea play better football, I think. First half at West Ham, game against North Zealand.
Better football than what?
Than what was the case previously under Roberto Di Matteo.
What, all of it? Like that first month when they were on fire and everyone was raving
about
them?
They were on fire. They had a line of three who were doing absolute wonders. That is absolutely true. But as a team performance from back to the front, yes, I thought that the most convincing performances have come, and I'm a bit the devil's advocate here, have come more recently. And I think that his impact has been very, very swift indeed. Very, very swift indeed. I also think that there are some decisions which are like the one of using Victor Moses far more to give some directness to their game, which they were perhaps lacking before that. But again, I'm being the devil's advocate.
Yeah. Well,
he's also helped to unite Chelsea's fans.
Well.
Mm. Well, there's always that caveat of who they've been facing in the last couple of games. But in the meantime, Sunderland now drop into the bottom three. With that defeat, they are facing Reading, the team immediately below them, on Tuesday night, Barry. That's a huge game at the bottom of the table.
Yeah, and I would imagine it's a game...
What do your bones tell you here?
I think it's a game fans of both teams fully expect their team to lose.
Right.
And whoever does lose is going to be in serious trouble. I think Reading will go down. I don't think Sunderland will, but, you know... Could be wrong about
what
that.
About QPR? Still unbeaten under Harry Redknapp, but still without a win after 16 games. And a 2-2 draw at Wigan that showed plenty of spirit. But is it just not enough? Do you think they're now 8 points from safety?
I think QPR's problem is essentially that they built a squad that they thought would be maybe pushing you know, towards the final or the top third of the table. And it clearly hasn't worked out. I think they overestimated the quality of certain players. They overestimated the quality of the manager that they've had in before. And now they're very busily kind of backtracking and getting to the point mentally, but perhaps also in terms of tactics on the pitch where they're actually fighting a relegation battle. And I don't think, you know, as much as I'd like to be making a dismissive comment about Redknapp, that you can really point the finger at him right now. Because, you know, it just hasn't been there long enough. And we know the way he does things. You know, he's going to bring in one or two players. He's already brought in three or four times before at other clubs. But, you know, as a football club owner, you only care about the bottom line. And that's why he still keeps getting employed, because people turn a blind eye to what he does or the way he does it because they like the results.
Hmm. Well, there is that assumption when he came in.
Bottom line is the word in QPR's case.
Huh, isn't it, though?
Clint Hill came out with some interesting comments after the game. Basically, he was incredibly critical of the owner's sort of scattergun approach to spending and player acquisition during the summer, which I thought was refreshing to hear a player talk so honestly, but possibly isn't going to do himself any favours with the club's hierarchy. But then again, maybe he doesn't care. I think it's players like him, Jamie Mackey and... what's his name?
Sean Derry.
Sean Derry.
Yeah. Roll up their sleeves, get stuck in.
Exactly.
It's a scrap down there.
But I said on Thursday, and nothing's happened to change. Well, I don't think there's hope in hell of staying up. And the talk coming out of the club already seems to be, you know, we are going down. And they'll struggle to attract players in January as well. If they're anchored to the bottom of the table, who's going to want to play for them?
It might not necessarily be a case of the players they should bring in, there's the players they should take out of that team. That's one of the big problems they have. Quite a few of the players that have been brought in this summer are players who have got a reputation, shall we say, when it comes to create a disharmony in the dressing room.
Who came
and
in this
it's all right to have one or two, as everybody will tell you, when you've got four, five, or six, or seven, that becomes a big problem.
All right, okay. The race for fourth place is certainly heating up, especially after that terrific come-from-behind Everton victory at home to Tottenham Hotspur. Everton are now on the same points as Spurs and West Brom. Arsenal are now only 2 points behind, and even Liverpool are within four now of the top four. My word. Well, the Everton game, first of all, loved the Jelovic goal and his long sequence of high fives afterwards. Magnificent team spirit going on there, no?
Yeah, I think we can all agree on that. I think we're all shaking. I think it was the nice, fluffy, warm moment of the weekend, really. Mm.
Certainly was.
Not for Spurs fans.
Not for Spurs fans, yeah. That's true.
Oh, yeah. Darren Gibson has played 48 times in the Premier League and has only been on the losing side four times. Incredible stat action on Football Weekly. What about Arsenal beating West Brom, huh? What about Cazorla's tumble?
Well, you mentioned a dive of the weekend.
It wasn't that one.
I know it wasn't that one, but I think Cazorla's was a lot worse
than the
one you're
telling. I'm not sure if he's being harshly treated, dear old Santi.
Oh,
there. Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah. I'm not sure. That's the thing. I find it a little bit hard.
He's been naughty. Santi's been naughty, and you're being too nice.
Am I? Yeah. Am I? Some people were mentioning Arsene Wenger's quotes. Philippe, I don't know if you remember this, when he was speaking out on the subject of divers. And what did he say, Rafa?
He said if it's an obvious dive, he'd support the... sanction of a 3-week ban.
A 3-game ban?
Retroactive ban, yeah.
Right. And do you see him bringing that in for his player here?
Personally, of course not, no.
Philippe, you were there at the Emirates.
I was there. Right. And it was interesting to listen to Arsene Wenger's reaction when the subject was brought to him at the press conference afterwards. Because he was very non-committal. He said he hadn't reviewed the incident on
That's
video.
Unusual.
But also said that should he... watch it and conclude that there was indeed a dive, an intent to dive. We certainly have a stern word or two with Santi Cazorla.
Oh, that's nice then. Good.
Well, just telling you.
Yeah.
You know, that was his reaction.
Big win against the previously highly fancied West Brom. And as I say, everything getting very, very tight there. Liverpool moving into the top four contention picture there. They're 10th, says producer Ben, but they are only 4 points off the top four in a very, very close middle part of the division. Something that the Premier League has in common with a lot of other top European divisions. But Liverpool, anyway, going to West Ham, I think a lot of people felt they were going to come a cropper here. No Luis Suarez. West Ham with a little bit of a thing going on there, having beaten Chelsea at home. And instead, the Reds powered away with a terrific goal from Glenn Johnson.
And a very good goal from Joe Cole. It was an interesting performance because I thought in the previous weeks... Liverpool were perhaps a little bit too sort of stylized. I mean, they tried to do specific things, but when it didn't work out necessarily, they kept on trying them. And I think this was a more kind of pragmatic, grittier performance. I mean, I'm talking very broad terms, but I think you saw that the team turned up and you saw a lot of players who perhaps not the most, you know, technically gifted players, putting in a really good performance, like Jonjo Shelvey. That's what you need, especially when everything's changing for a second time in as many years. You can't just have everything sort of theoretical and say, you know, now we're playing this way, now we're playing that way. You need these guys to actually work very, very hard, and that's what they did.
Right. What about Jonjo Shelvey and his goggle eye goal celebration? It's Pan's Labyrinth, I'm told.
Is it?
Apparently,
oh, yes, of course.
Pan's Labyrinth, yeah.
Of course, yes.
Very, very scary.
That's a very disturbing image.
It is a very disturbing
yes.
image. The film or Jonjo Shelvey himself?
Both.
Right.
Yeah, but it's Jonjo Shelvey in the film.
Because there was
When I watch the video now,
right.
I will have...
You'll have nightmares of Jonjo Shelvey.
Yes, absolutely. Ooh, but this said... It's also a game that was determined, the course was determined as well by an incident, which was the injury to Mohamed Diame. Mm. Just as the introduction of Diame had changed the game completely against Chelsea the week before that, just the fact he got injured, again, he had been absolutely tremendous. And they did lose this impetus in midfield, which Liverpool exploited with grit and determination.
What's the prognosis on Diame?
He's torn his hamstring and he could be out for 3 months.
Wow.
Which may be a blessing in disguise for West Ham, because a lot of clubs were sniffing around him with a view to signing him in the January transfer window, and this could possibly put them off. I don't
interesting,
know.
Interesting. What's the prognosis in the meantime on Vincent Kompany, whose injury and withdrawal against Man United possibly had a bit of a hand in that defeat?
Yeah, it didn't help. They are certainly a team who can do with some leadership. It's not really a word I'd like to use very often when it comes to football, because I think it's sort of sometimes overrated. But for City, I think he is an absolute key player. They haven't had a settled back four or back three or back five this season. And I think it's unsettled him, but you'd still prefer an unsettled Vincent Kompany to some of the other guys they have there. So that is certainly a problem. It's a groin injury. Hard to know how serious it is. It can be very serious. I mean, if you remember last year, Steven Gerrard, I think he was out for 4 months with a groin injury, but it can also be a very minor thing.
Right, okay. One thing we haven't mentioned is Brave Norwich and their brave win at Swansea. How come they're still down in 12th place? That's now 10 games unbeaten, Norwich.
I think after 7 games, they still had no win.
Right.
And they were just 1 point ahead of QPR. I think
right.
that should tell you all you need to know
okay.
why this record-breaking sequence that they've had. They've beaten Arsenal, Manchester United and Swansea at Swansea in those 9 games, which is very, very impressive indeed.
Right.
One thing you would say for Norwich is that exactly like Roberto Martinez at Wigan, Chris Hughton, regardless of his qualities as a manager, is totally unflappable in terms of his reaction to defeat. He has this air of calm about him when you hear him speak after, you know, a reverse anywhere. Just like Roberto Martinez, this great confidence he has in his, obviously in himself and his team, and that has helped them.
Well,
but also, I mean, they're a very decent team to watch, I must say.
They certainly looked it on Saturday, and next up in the Capital One Cup quarterfinals, they're going to be hosting their old chum, Paul Lambert, who's arriving in town with his Aston Villa, who had a 0-0 with Stoke that was eminently forgettable. In other Capital One Cup quarterfinal news, Barry, Middlesbrough are on the road again.
Yes, this is Middlesbrough's 12th Capital One Cup tie away from home in a row.
No way.
12 consecutive ties. So I got on the AA route finder this morning, slow day, and worked out that if a Middlesbrough fan had attended all those matches and left, like, from the Riverside Stadium on the bus to go to the next, they'd have completed a round trip of 4,134 miles on their way to and from... this is Swansea to come, then Sunderland, Preston, Gillingham, Bury, Walsall, Peterborough, Palace, Millwall, Chesterfield, Nottingham Forest and Man United all away from home.
I have to say I'm a little bit disappointed with that number. I thought it was going to be bigger.
Did you? Yeah,
yeah, 12 away games. I just,
well,
yeah.
Swansea will have been the furthest. That's 322 miles there,
right,
and 322 miles back. Of course, the one before that was just Sunderland, which is only 32 miles.
Right.
Round trip is 64.
Right.
What's that, producer Ben? That's enough for part two. All right then. Super. Well, next up on today's Football Weekly, we're off to Europe. There's Spain, France, Germany, and a bit of Italy. So stay with us. How are you, Sid?
I'm all right, thanks, James. How are
good.
You?
Good.
Sid, have you cleaned up your after your jam catastrophe?
You know,
and
what?
How did you do it?
It's a proper catastrophe. I had cleaned up, or thought I had, and then later on the evening, well, the floor's still sticky, and then found bits of glass everywhere.
Ooh.
It's an exploding sticky bomb. Dangerous, isn't it?
Well, it certainly is. How did it happen, Sid?
I dropped a jam jar on the floor.
Right. Really was that simple. Okay.
What were you expecting to have happened?
I'm just checking.
Poltergeistal activity.
Absolutely.
I didn't try and do a Dave Bevan to control it. That would have been much worse.
That certainly would, Sid. Now, in other news, a record-breaking weekend in Spain. Falcao gets 5 and Messi beats that Gerd Müller record at last.
Yeah, and well, at last, the thing with Messi is you say at last, it sort of does feel like at last, but at the same time, it also feels ridiculously quick.
Yeah.
Because in midweek, it looked like the chance had been snatched away from him forever.
Forever.
You know, with that injury against Benfica, with only 4 games left of the season, left of the calendar year. And it looked like he was out, and he was on a stretch, and he was carried off, and all the rest of it. And Messi himself said that, which I thought was perhaps the most telling bit of it, when he clashed with a goalkeeper and the ball spun away, he went towards it and had a shot. It was kind of this sort of falling backwards, desperate attempt to score. And he said, well, I thought it was the last time I was going to touch a ball for a very long time. As it turns out, 4 days later, he's in the starting 11 against Betis. After 19 minutes, he's equaled the record. After 25 minutes, he's broken it. So just no hanging around at all from him.
Mm. Here's a bit of heresy.
Brilliant goals as well. There were goals that summed him up. And the first was just completely a Messi goal. I mean, you know, you see, if you saw that goal 15 times and you didn't know who'd scored it, you'd say, yeah, it's Messi.
Right. More Messi action than your kitchen floor, Sid. Here's a bit of heresy from Paul Holly in Spain. Is La Liga as good as everyone thinks with Messi, Ronaldo, Falcao scoring so many goals? Is this what it is, Sid? Is defending just a bit rubs in Spain?
No, right. I think this needs to be analysed properly. The trouble is we'll probably go on for ages and you lot get bored and start doodling. But I think certainly the strength of Madrid and Barcelona over everyone else, of course, is a factor. There's no doubt about that. But I'm not sure it's really about poor defending. In fact, I think the defending is poorer in England. Certainly tactically and positionally, I think the defending is much poorer in England. And, you know, there's lots of examples of players who didn't score that many in Spain and went and scored loads in England and vice versa. You know, Michu at the moment has got, I think a couple off what he got in the whole of last season in Spain. And so I think it's not quite as simple as that, but certainly for Madrid and Barcelona has an impact. And that, of course, doesn't explain Falcao's record. And there's another thing that's worth pointing out. People say, well, I'd like to see Messi do it in a proper league. Well, the Champions League is quite a difficult league. And he's been top scorer in that 4 seasons in a row.
Right, fair enough. Anyway, so he beats Müller's record with 86 goals now, and he's still got, 3 or 4 games to go. But it's nice that this Müller fella is getting a little bit of publicity. Rafi, you know a little bit about him.
Yeah, I mean, that really is the nicest way that came out of which is really essentially a manufactured stat, because no one's ever, I think, you know, a month ago had any idea, certainly in Germany, that Gerd Müller had this record, because, you know, they were looking at all sorts of real and more meaningful numbers. This is feels a little bit like an artificial trophy, as it were, or honour. But it's really nice to see the amount of publicity he does get and the his proper place in the sort of pantheon of football greats being recognised.
Mm.
And he's an incredibly nice guy because, unfortunately, he's a little bit poor right now. Hasn't really been in a position to appreciate what's going on with Messi, etc. But when our good friend Pippo Inzaghi broke his European Cup record, Bild, German tabloid, got them both together in a room, and Müller hugged Inzaghi and said, "It's great that you're doing this, and I congratulate you," and was just the nicest guy possible. So I'm sure if he was in a position, he'd be doing exactly the same with Messi.
Oh, One of the reports I was reading today saying that he almost signed for Barcelona years and years ago. They got Cruyff because they missed out on...
Yeah, it's a really interesting story. I had absolutely no idea about this, but apparently in 73 they'd agreed a deal, but with the World Cup coming up in Germany, politics got involved, and apparently the German Inland Revenue Service... prohibited somehow, said, you know, this would attract tax if you do the steal. So he was prevented from moving. And as you said, they got Cruyff instead, which, you know, then going forward with the whole Barcelona philosophy is quite interesting, because Müller, for all his goals, was never a great man when it came to philosophy and tactics. So, you know, history of football could have developed in a very different way if that had happened.
The fee, apparently, for Müller that they'd agree was £150,000, the equivalent of... Remarkable. Sid, is he still talking, Sid, there? Sid, are you still there?
I'm still here, yeah.
Excellent. All right, now, Falcao, 5 goals. They were absolutely astonishing, as you were saying. So they remain, 6 points behind Barcelona on the top of the table. Real Madrid, meanwhile, 11 points back still.
Yeah, Atletico Madrid with five-point lead over Real Madrid. Madrid won 3-2 at the weekend, and as you say, Atletico Madrid 6-0. Falcao got 5. Last person to score 5 in a Spanish league game was 2002, was Fernando Morientes. And that day, Morientes missed a penalty as well. One of the reasons I think he missed a penalty was that he couldn't take it with his head, because he scored the 5 goals. 4 of them had been headers.
Wow. What else have we got? No one's sacked this week yet?
No one's sacked, which is perhaps a bit of a surprise, actually, because there's two coaches on the verge of it, Ankeller at Granada and Joaquin Caparrós at Mallorca, who, funnily enough, Joaquin Caparrós's Mallorca side have been absolutely awful ever since I wrote a column saying they were absolutely brilliant.
Now, Barry, what would you like to hear about next? Bundesliga, Serie A, or Ligue 1?
Oh, no pressure. I'd like to hear about Bundesliga.
Oh, Barry.
He's a man of good taste.
Take it away.
Come on, then. Fine.
No, the reason for that is because I know what happened in Serie A and Liga, and I have no idea what happened in the Bundesliga.
All right, then. Well, what happened in the Bundesliga, then?
Well, what happened was that basically the championship is over, and Bayern are expected to be handed the trophy come March, because they're now 11 points clear. Off Leverkusen, who are not really being seen as serious contenders anyway. So they're 14 points clear of Dortmund, who slipped up yet again. Bayern won 2-0 against Augsburg in a very tough game away at Augsburg. But Dortmund were very, very unlucky, because they were 1-0 up against Wolfsburg when the referee, Wolfgang Stark, who hails from Bavaria and has had some run-ins with Dortmund before, sent off Marcel Schmelzer for a alleged handball on the line, which was later revealed was nowhere near his hand. So not only did Wolfsburg equalize from the penalty and go on to win the game 3-2, but also Schmelzer was sent off. And they're trying very, very hard not to be completely irate, but they kind of failed, because on the Dortmund official website, they had someone post all the mistakes that Stark had made, not only in that game, but also in previous Dortmund games. And, you know, it kind of puts all the effort that they made in the German Classico, the great game against Bayern, a week ago when they drew 1-1. It's all for nothing in a way, because, you know, they lost at home to Wolfsburg, and 14 points. Thomas Müller, no relation to Gerd, said Dortmund are out of it. And it's hard to argue with that. So it was a very decisive, you feel, monumental match day in the Bundesliga.
How long has it been since Bayern were champions, so to speak, so early in the season? I mean, you know, previous seasons, you know, you have to go back quite a long time, don't you?
Well, they've had a few seasons where they were leading from the first to the last game. But I don't think anyone's ever gone into winter break with a lead this high. I mean, there's still one game to go, so it could go back to 8. Mm. But it could also, of course, go to 14. They're playing Mönchengladbach on Friday night.
And then
it's the winter break. Mm. There's one more cup game, but yeah, it's looking very ominous at the moment. And you wonder what they'll do for them when it comes to the Champions League, because that is, of course, the sort of overall aim for the season, to go one further. If they win really early, or if they really, you know, find it very easy, shall we say, to win this title, does that then create a problem, because you're lacking intensity, you're lacking rhythm, and the obvious idea will always be to rest one or two players along the way, or will it make them a lot fresher than all the competition. It's an interesting dilemma that I think we'll see in the spring.
All right, Borussia Dortmund, in the meantime, you'd think now would be focusing very much on the Champions League. Jurgen Klopp, his future?
His future is at Dortmund. There's absolutely no way that he can be shifted in the next couple of years. I mean, Joachim Löw is probably hanging up his boots in the summer of 2014 after the World Cup. So, you know, Klopp will definitely be number one candidate. It's up to him whether he wants the job. My feeling is that he'll continue for at least another 2 years, try to really create a legacy, to really leave his mark at a club. And he's already done a lot in the last 4 years. And, you know, make them a genuine European superpower, which they can be if you look at the kind of the structure and the size of the club.
What kind of money does Jurgen Klopp get in Bundesliga when you compare that to what he would be offered in Spain, England or Italy?
Well, he's nowhere near sort of Mourinho money, but then very few managers are. I mean, he'd be eminently affordable, you know, in terms of wages. But that's not even the problem. I think the problem for him would be, can I communicate as well as I do in another language? Because that's a key part of his factor. He is an ideal coach. Why? Because he can have all the tactical know-how and all the great ideas that he has about football and how the game should be played, but he can also communicate that and be very motivational and be very emotional in his address to the players. And you'd wonder how much of that would be lost in translation. So, you know, that's another thing where I think he'd be very careful before he makes that move. But he will eventually, I think, go on to do even bigger things.
Can I ask another question?
Go on then, Philippe. It's all coming off your League One roundup, though.
Yeah, that's fine. But I was like everybody. I stopped in my tracks when I read that Bayern, obviously, Jupp Heynckes is coming to the end of his tenure at Bayern Munich. He's 67 years old, isn't he? And that Pep Guardiola was talked about as and when I thought about it, and in with all the hypotheses that are flying around at the moment, you think, well, actually, that one really makes an awful lot of sense to me. Does it make a lot of sense to you?
Well, for Bayern, it would make sense to go after him. But again, I mean, you can flip the Klopp thing around and say, you know, does Pep Guardiola work in German? That's a big question mark. And does he work at Bayern, where he's only ever really worked at Barcelona before? These are all vagaries. And, you know, Bayern is not the kind of club like Arsenal where they're going to say, OK, 7 years, you know, we'll give you a few years before you win something and we'll be happy with the vision and the perspective and developing players. No, he has to win straight away. But, and here it gets interesting, I mean, they made an attempt to sound out his views in May. They spoke to his brother, who's not really technically speaking his agent, but has, of course, a connection there. And they were encouraged, but it was the obvious sort of come back in 6 months. We have no idea what Pep wants. And Pep, I think, himself has no idea what he wants. Now, there was a story in the Sunday Times from his agent saying that Pep is now considering Bayern. And you just wonder, is that a message to Bayern or is that actually a message to City or to Paris Saint-Germain, who I think are still much more likely destinations for him?
Or the Ukraine FA. Huntelaar to Arsenal. Yes, no?
A month ago I would have said absolutely impossible.
Right.
Things are so bad at Schalke, though, and this will be the topic of my column.
Oh.
That all the bets are off right now. There's even talk of Huub Stevens being fired in the winter break.
Wow.
It's gone so bad in such a small space of time. And Huntelaar's been playing so badly, and so with a Balotelli-esque lack of effort, that now there's almost a view emerging that, you know, if somebody does come in with money, which would be nuts to sign him now, really, when you can get him for free 6 months down the line.
Unless you're desperate for a goal scorer.
Unless you're desperate. But even if you are desperate, you're much better off signing him for free and getting him in 6 months. Anyway, it's no longer impossible. But I still think it's unlikely because if you think from his perspective and from Schalke's perspective, it might much better to leave the money, as it were, on the pitch and qualify for the Champions League again. They're in the knockout stages. You know, do you want a Huntelaar or do you want £10 million in your pocket, but you have to spend that on someone else in January, who are you going to get? Chances are you're going to get somebody a lot worse, and you don't know if they're going to succeed. So it makes little sense, I think, from the club's perspective.
Would they even get £10 million for him?
He's 29, isn't he? It's resale value almost zilch.
It's impossible to know what the value is, because usually these kind of deals don't happen 6 months before the end of contract, but for obvious reason. As a player, you don't really make that move unless you think in 6 months I'm not going to have that offer. And the reason why you don't make that move is because, you know, whatever sum Schalke will get, you could actually pocket yourself if you don't go in January. So it doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Mm. Now we're heading towards the end of today's podcast, but still standing against the wall waiting to be picked. The two sickly-looking children of Ligue 1 and Serie A. Which one, Barry? Which?
I think Rafa should choose.
Go on then, Rafa. Ligue 1, where you go, Philippe?
Me?
Now, yes, let's
Ligue 1.
See. Last time I looked at Ligue 1, it was ever so tight, there were six teams neck and neck.
It's tightish.
No, it's not. Now you've got Lyon romping 5 points clear. What kind
of
league do you call that?
No, they're not romping away.
Yes, they are.
Away.
They beat Saint-Étienne.
They beat Saint-Étienne in the big derby. It's with the so-called Plastico Paris Saint-Germain OM. It's the most heated derby in French football, Saint-Étienne-Lyon. And a game, by the way, that was more interesting for the result than for what was actually played on the pitch, which was rather poor.
Aye.
Michel Bastos giving the winner a terrible goalkeeping mistake by Gruffier. But there you go. Yes, they're top of the league, which is a bit of a surprise, because when you look at what Lyon have had to do since they decided to move into that new stadium, they've completely, well, they've got rid of their bigger players. The players they've brought in are either coming from the academy or were at cut prices and so forth. And they're really, it was supposed to be a transitory season. And it's far, far more than that, with a young coach, Rémy Garde, as well. So they're doing everything right. But I think the situation will change very, very quickly. If you look at what's happening, we've got a crazy schedule before the winter break. Absolutely crazy. We're playing on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday and Sunday.
Wow.
Just in the league.
Huh?
And the game that everybody is waiting for is on the 16th, which is when Lyon are playing at Parc des Princes against PSG.
Right.
So things could change very, very quickly indeed.
Paris Saint-Germain got back to winning ways with a 4-0 win, was it, against Evian?
4-0 win against Evian Tonon-Gaillard. But Evian Tonon-Gaillard is in the relegation zone and doing very badly. And Paris Saint-Germain just, you know, taking on the form they'd shown against Porto. They were terrific, by the way, against Porto in the Champions League. And just doing the business without Ibrahimovic, another goal.
Right.
Yet another one. That's 14 goals now for him in the French league.
Crazy.
Ridiculous.
Yeah.
Looking okay. But the big news of the weekend was Marseille being beaten at home again.
Right.
It was terrible.
Joey Barton watch here. Now, he got 8 out of 10 midweek, wasn't it?
He didn't get 8 out of 10 this time.
Right.
He got a 5.
Ooh.
Mm. I mean, OM were poor. Very, very poor indeed. And it was the first time in their history that they'd been beaten by 3 goals at home in succession, in 2 successive games.
Wow.
And the first time against OL, Lyon, and the second time, this weekend, against Lorient, for whom Jérémy Aliadière scored. Do you remember him?
Yeah, Aliadière.
Aliadière, you know. And Marseille were awful.
Right.
There was chance of... they want their chairman to resign and the usual stuff.
Is it still the absence of Loic Remy and all that?
Loic Remy was playing, but
He
was playing, but not very well. His confidence is not short. It's non-existent, basically, at the moment.
All right.
OM is in a bad way. But when Lyon hasn't romped away with anything yet, fully expect PSG to be back in there very, very quickly.
We shall see. The hot transfer poop sees Patrice Evra. Perhaps,
I've heard about that, and I must say I've tried to find the source of it, and I couldn't. So I'm a little bit cagey about telling you a lot about that.
Okay,
I'm more interested in what's happening with Snyder, because there seems to be an eel under the rock, as we say in French, that there is some genuine contact here.
There's an eel under the rock.
Une anguille sous le rocher. But anyway, yes, I mean, they're looking for a left back. The player that they were interested in the most was Ashley Cole.
Yeah.
And the idea that Patrice Evra would somehow decide to leave Manchester United in mid-season to go to PSG seems a little bit far-fetched to me. But Snyder, you know, I was literally trying to...
Oh, you were trying to throw in a bit
of...
Throwing... Wow, we talked a lot about this Snyder business, and again, he wasn't playing at the weekend. The club said that he had an ankle problem. His wife said on the Twitter that she's not supposed to be saying anything on. She said that he was fine. Mm-hmm. So that situation rumbles on. It does seem like Inter handling it spectacularly badly. They did have Cassano back this weekend in the big second against third clash at San Siro, in which they beat Napoli 2-1. Napoli have an absolutely terrible record. When people talk about them as title contenders, this is always the kind of rub to it. They just can't beat top teams. Their record over the last five seasons is played 25 against teams in the top five, 1-0. Anyway, terrific first goal there for Inter. And if you saw the marvellous, it was a lovely set piece. It was an Inter corner. And what they did was they stationed Freddy Guarin, on the halfway line so that nobody was picking him up at all. And then as the guy runs up to take the corner, he just belts it, runs full pitch toward He just runs full pelt towards the goal and arrives just as the ball is just about to touch ground and just whams it straight in. Super, super. Anyway, 2-1 win for Napoli. In other Serie A news, it was hail Juventus in a very real sense in their game away to Palermo. A massive hailstorm indeed at half-time, rendering the pitch at La Favorita almost impracticable. But Andrea Pirlo proved a master of the conditions, lifting a divine ball across to Vucinic, who chested it down and then backheeled it into the path of the oncoming Steven Lichtenstein, who whammed it in. A similar series of touches led to Leonardo Bonucci having a glorious one-on-one with the Palermo keeper late on, Barry. And yes, we've arrived at the moment, the dive of the weekend.
I don't think this was worse than Santa Cazorla.
It was
I'm
awful.
Sorry.
Okay,
it was
so
bad. But
he approaches the goalkeeper. He takes the ball one way. The goalkeeper follows him. He takes the ball the other way. Goalkeeper follows him. He realizes he's run out of room. He is literally now standing right next to the goalkeeper. A second passes while he considers his options. And he goes, as somebody commented, for the, "Oh, Vic, I've fallen over," Bob Mortimer routine, throwing his hands up in the air and tumbling to the ground. Magnificent. Sorry, Rafa.
Yeah, I mean, it's an awful dive, but the goalkeeper does stick his hand up, and there's at least some kind of contact. Whereas with Cazorla, I think he just fell into thin air.
There was contact between the goalkeeper and
he was
Bonucci.
Standing upright. The goalkeeper waves an arm which just about caresses his inner thigh.
Yeah.
At which point,
but weren't his,
he tumbled,
his,
he throws his arms up in the air.
Weren't his shins
that's enough
up
to
against?
Get to,
yeah,
yes, they were. Later.
They were, but he was stationary.
Yeah, but Cazorla, there was no contact
yeah, there,
of any kind.
There might have been contact
with
yeah.
Stephen Reid.
Well, I think a hyperlink might await you at the top of the Football Weekly page. Anyway, that was Bonucci, who did have the good grace to apologise on Twitter afterwards. Of course, the real story, apart from De Jong being out for the rest of the season after doing something really nasty, but I can't think what it was.
Achilles
tendon, that's it. In a Milan 4-2 win away to Torino, the real story was Francesco Totti rolling back the years once again in an absolutely terrific game on Saturday night. I don't know if anyone saw this, Roma-Fiorentina. You did, Philippe?
Yep.
Oh, it was magnificent.
It was superb.
It certainly was. And how about him, eh? 221 goals now.
So only two to beat to be the all-time record?
I think he
record
needs four. No, no, no. The all-time record, I don't see him getting. Cause
no, no, no. Only two. Yes, only two players.
Oh,
have
only
scored,
two players. Sorry,
have
yeah.
scored more than him.
Yeah, Gunnar Nordahl, the legend of Milan, is only, I think, four goals ahead of him. But the whole thing is that Totti, who spent most of his career as a midfielder, so it's pretty extraordinary. It was only kind of midway through his career when Roma's all their forwards got knackered that Spalletti kind of invented him as this kind of original false number nine. And Totti saying, anyway, is Zeman's football. We're all listening to Zeman now, and it shows. It's just extraordinary that he, of all the players to flourish under this Zeman kind of mad run around and play like lunatics tactics, that he would be the standout player. But he was absolutely superb.
Gabby Marcotti has a column in the Times
he
today
certainly
saying,
does.
Talking about Totti and how he's just sort of adapted his play because obviously he's not getting any younger. And yeah, it's worth a read.
He was all 36. Over the pitch on Saturday. 36
yeah. years old.
But not only 36, but he missed two seasons almost with various leg operations and knee problems. So it's just amazing to see him come back, and a player more committed to his club, you would be harder to find. One player who's not so in favour in the Zeman setup is, of course, Daniele De Rossi, who was suspended, came back from suspension this weekend, and was duly placed on the bench by Zeman, which, you know, we talked about the situation with Snyder at Inter. The De Rossi one does seem that Roma would certainly accept offers for him. Yeah, I think Snyder would get a fair price as well, don't you?
15? That's what people say in Paris.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, the problem with Snyder is not so much the transfer fee as the wages and right. the fact that they're paid net of tax in Italy.
Well, De Rossi as well is an problem. Absolutely massive wage. I think he's one of the top paid players in Serie A. So, right. Well, that's there you go. That was brief, wasn't it? The Golf Badger says, just to let you know, I've upped my game, Barry, and I'm still alive.
Great. Brilliant.
There you go.
Oh, and the one thing... I just wanted to get a little shout-out for Kevin Kilbane, who retired at the weekend.
Yes.
I thought he'd retired about 6 months ago, but apparently he hadn't. He was at Coventry. 110 caps for Ireland.
Right.
Absolute gentleman. Sort of some people say he's arguably the nicest footballer ever to have set foot
really?
On a pitch. And, yeah, hats off to him for a great career.
I can vouch for that. I would vouch for that as one of the most pleasant people.
I remember Niall Quinn once told me that he's the only man alive who Niall Quinn would be happy to hear was marrying his daughter.
Really? Yeah. The only man alive?
Yeah.
Why is he retiring now, not at the end of the season?
I don't know. He took time off for personal reasons. I don't know what those personal reasons are, but he's come back now and just said, no, that's it.
Well, Niall Quinn's another famously nice footy man, forking out from his own pocket for taxis for stranded Sunderland fans
yeah. down in Cardiff, I think.
Yeah, what's the nicest thing Kevin Kilbane's ever done then?
I don't know. You think maybe he's not one for the big gestures, right? Just, you know, ongoing cumulative niceness.
Okay, good for him.
But you would struggle to find anyone with a bad word to say about him as a bloke. A lot of people have bad words to say about his abilities as a footballer, and much of the criticism he gets is unfair. But.
Well, that's a challenge for you, hundreds of thousands of Football Weekly listeners. If one of you has been ill-treated by jumped-up footy type, vile footy star Kevin Kilbane, he's probably wiped his bum with your small change or something. Let us know. Now, that's it for today. We'll be back with a more homogeneous Football Weekly Extra on Thursday. But in the meantime, many thanks to Raphael Honigstein. Looking forward to reading your column, Philippe Auclair, and Barry Glendening, and you, the listener, and producer Ben. Have a lovely week till Thursday.